Today I'm joined by Danny Bartlett, who is a Quality Assurance and Governance Lead.
Quality Assurance Lead for DPPs for the Independent Prescribing course at the University of Brighton.
Do they have capacity to take you on? Do they have experience? And are they in the patient-facing role? Have they taken prescribing trainees before? Is a really good one, because they might know the lay of the land if they already have done it before.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to our DPP Connect podcast series. My name is Holly Lawrence and I'm your host today, and I'm joined by Danny Bartlett, our Quality Assurance and Governance Lead for our DPP Finder service and the DPP Lead for the University of Brighton. Hi Danny again, nice to have
Hi.
You here.
How's it going, Holly?
Good, thank you. Today we'll be discussing how to know whether you have a good DPP. So this podcast is for those who are planning to do their IP course and applying to universities but are not too sure where to start and want to ensure that they pass their university examinations. So Danny, for those students who are applying, what does the university look for when they're accepting or rejecting a student?
I think so. Different universities have very slightly different kind of criteria. I think I can only obviously speak for Brighton University in terms of what I look for, but it's definitely someone that's in a patient-facing role, someone with prescribing experience, not a tangible number of years, but some prescribing experience where they feel confident enough in their own abilities to then supervise a trainee and be able to guide them through the training. And yeah, just someone that has access to patients to be able to run clinics and things like that, and then have a trainee in tandem to be able to supervise.
Perfect. What about a student applying to the university course? What do you specifically look for?
We want to make sure that the student has a DPP in place. We want to make sure that they've got that agreed supervision with someone that is going to be able to look after their 90 hours of supervision, 45 of which is obviously with that DPP. So we need to make sure that's locked in before we accept a person onto the course. We want to make sure they respond to the application in time, but also they give detailed answers about actually how the prescribing course will benefit them as a professional. And quite often that's the bit of information lacking. And actually, quite often a student will apply to the course because they maybe feel that they have to do it, but actually they haven't reflected on how it will be amazing and benefit their practice. So I think it's really important for students to think, well, actually, I'm becoming a prescriber for a particular reason. And sometimes they overlook that on the application form. So that's one of my top tips.
Absolutely. And conversely, in your experience, what could cause a university to reject a student?
So if they all of the opposites, basically, Holly, so if they don't have a DPP in place, if they haven't given enough detail around reflecting over what the course will offer them in terms of progression and development in their own abilities, what their scope is quite often as well. So quite often they haven't thought about a scope that actually relates to the role they're currently in. They might have kind of picked a scope out of thin air that they're interested in, but they're not actively in that role where they're seeing patients. So there has to be that link where they're actually in a role, or at least being supervised for the duration of the course, where they have access to patients within the scope of practice they've put on the form. So there's obviously quite a lot to fill out on the form and think about, but I think it's really important. You don't want to go into a course and not meet all of the learning objectives because you've not kind of started it off as you mean to go on.
Perfect. So as you mentioned, universities require students to have a DPP when applying for their IP course. And obviously we've heavily spoken about DPPs in our previous podcasts and sort of what they are. Can you tell us a little bit more about what students should look for when deciding or choosing a DPP?
I think it needs to be someone that is in an active patient-facing role that they feel will look after their supervision and be there on hand for what they need for being able to pass the course. They need to be someone that's not going to charge them thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds to not then be available. So they need that kind of continuity of support and supervision. And I think quite often you don't know that going in. When you kind of reach out to a DPP you've never met before and you put them on a form, you don't know any of that kind of tangible information.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly we've had experiences where students have perhaps sort of not got on with their DPP, or the DPPs have been unreliable and they've dropped out suddenly and we've had to find them an alternative. So it's probably a bit of a controversial question, but have you got any ideas on sort of the red flags to look out for to prevent students being in this situation?
I think asking the right questions of the DPP before you put them down would be really key. So do they have capacity to take you on? Do they have experience? And are they in the patient-facing role? Have they taken prescribing trainees before is a really good one, because they might know the lay of the land if they already have done it before. How much do they charge is a really important question, because I do think that absolutely, if you're supervising someone in a prescribing course, you should be paid your backfill time, because it does take a bit of time to supervise someone, but you shouldn't be making a profit off of supervising someone, in my view. So I think that those are kind of key questions you can start the ball rolling with.
Absolutely. So what do you think makes DPP Connect different, and how can we assure good quality DPPs for our students?
I think we have a very obvious and what I like to call a wicked problem in the DPP shortage. So I think we have lots of students or potential students that really want a DPP, but they can't find one, or maybe students that had a DPP that's then left, they need another DPP to take that DPP's place. So I think that DPP Connect kind of helps to try and bridge that gap. I think we do have a bit of the Wild West, as I like to call it, of DPPs charging the earth and then not actually following through the supervision. I think we have students that just can't find one, and we also have a variety of kind of competence of DPPs where you're not sure they've supervised someone before, you're not sure if they're going to supervise that student well, and they're not going to be that supportive and provide that supportive learning environment that they should be doing for that, that student to succeed. So I think the governance and the quality assurance process that at least we've kind of developed through DPP Connect is something that I kind of instill in my role as the DPP QA lead at the University of Brighton. It's certainly something that I'm very passionate about, and it's something that I think more universities need to get on board with, is that we need to make sure we're screening the DPPs and scrutinising them as much as we do the students, because they're as important as the students, if not more so. And I think DPP Connect is that kind of third party extra layer of scrutiny on the DPP, so to speak, that means that we're looking at them a bit closer, vetting them to not only support them, but also support the students that are going to go through them.
Absolutely. And thinking about the quality assurance, you know, we have in place at DPP Connect, do you know if there's anything else sort of in existence at the moment in terms of quality assurances sort of outside of DPP Connect?
I don't personally, to be honest, Holly. I do think obviously the universities have their processes, and I think that is still absolutely valid. I don't think it replaces that, but I think that we are the only kind of organisation that are actually kind of trying to pull these DPPs together, matchmake them with students that are perhaps finding it difficult, but also vetting them at the same time. So I certainly haven't heard of anything at the moment. It's obviously the pro-pharmace training for people that want to aspire to become a DPP, which I think is absolutely incredible, and we should signpost people to do that as well. But as a matchmaking service, I think we're probably out there on our own at the moment.
Okay. And thinking about the student's experience then, if the student is having problems with their DPP, what can they do?
So at the moment, in the old model, if you like, is that they would have to reach out to the university. They would then have to kind of broker the conversation. If it's broken down between them and the DPP, they would then have to reach out to the university to almost kind of negotiate that between the two of them. But actually, that's really tricky. So I think that in the newer model with us is that we're that extra third party, that extra kind of layer of support. But also means we're quite removed from the situation in order to make kind of facilitative decisions and also to be able to help kind of engage in dialogue. So absolutely, my first port of call, if you're having a concern where you're a trainee and you feel like you're not getting what you kind of want from your DPP, you reach out to your DPP first. But when that relationship breaks down or you're hitting a brick wall with that, I think we offer a bit of a novel solution, being that kind of extra layer. And I also think it reduces the burden on universities as well, because I only work one day a week at Brighton University. I've got a full-time clinical role as well, and actually I can't be fielding all of these DPP queries as well as doing everything else. So actually, I think DPP Connect can be useful in that realm as well.
Absolutely. So our training coordinator can step in to support the student and the DPP. And obviously, if we needed to match them with an alternative, then we can do. So moving on to students successfully passing their university examinations, I understand that students doing their IP course have a number of examinations. So they have to complete OSCEs, portfolios and written assessments. What advice can you give to ensure students pass these examinations first time round?
So I think splitting it up into two chunks is probably the easiest way to explain it. I'm not going to give any secrets away, to be honest, because there aren't any. But if you've got a university course and you've got all the work associated with that, so the exams, the portfolio, the OSCEs, etc. But then you've also got your supervision, and it's intertwined, right? So if you have really bad supervision, your portfolio is going to be really bad. If you don't get your good quality DPP to kind of shepherd you through your learning outcomes and your course, you're going to fail your exam. So they are intertwined. And I think my tip for passing is make sure that you've got that really good relationship from the get-go. Make sure that you've got that learning needs assessment at the beginning, that you know exactly where you are at the moment and where you need to be at the end of the course. And then that will kind of then kick you on and make sure that by the time you come to sit your OSCEs and your exams and the time you kind of come to portfolio develop and compile all of your data and your evidence into your portfolio, it's going to be much better than it would have done if you just didn't do any of that first bit of work and then you came to it and rushed it at the end, so to speak. So I think put the effort in beginning, make sure you've got those relationships and those learning needs assessments, and then that will kind of yield really good outcomes from the exams.
Absolutely. And have you got any advice on how to write a good portfolio?
I think my main thing that I look for is variety, and variety in terms of the types of patients you're dealing with, types of interactions with multi-professionals, the types of environments you're in. So you might sit in a face-to-face clinic, you might have a telephone clinic, it might be a different variety, but also the patients are going to be completely different. Each patient's going to be a variety on the last one that you saw. So patients with loads of medication as opposed to a patient maybe younger with only one or two medications, patient with learning difficulties, or a patient that's maybe elderly and frail. There's loads of different connotations of it. There's no kind of one rule fits all, but actually seeing the variety means that I know that you've seen a variety of different patients, so you're going to come out as more of a complete prescriber. And then the other kind of tip that I guess I have is making sure that everything that you put in your portfolio relates back to why that has improved you as a prescriber. So all of your 90 hours should have improved you after you finish those hours and that time as a prescriber. And that's why the variety is really important. So, and it doesn't all need to be patient facing. So for example, let's say for an hour you attended a multidisciplinary team meeting with lots of prescribers, that's going to be so beneficial to you as a prescriber. You might not have necessarily seen a patient in that hour, but actually you were around lots of prescribers talking about frail and elderly patients. And actually you probably took away from that loads and loads of information. So absolutely put that in your portfolio. And I think that rather than kind of rambling on, the last kind of bit with that is that lots of people think that all of the 90 hours have to be patient facing. But when you think about the nuance and the things that are available to us, like meetings, multidisciplinary team catch-ups and debriefs and things like that, they're all really beneficial. And I would encourage people to make sure their portfolio has some of that in there as well.
Thank you, Danny. That's some really good advice. So just to finish off as a final question, Danny, for those pharmacists who are applying to university for their IP course, what three top tips can you give them as a university lecturer?
I think so. Make sure that you've got your good quality DPP locked in. Make sure that you've put a scope of practice down that is realistic to the patients that you are going to be encountering as part of your supervision. And make sure that in your application, you reference and you know yourself why the course and becoming a prescriber is going to change your practice and improve it no end. And I think that those three top tips, you've got those locked in, you'll sail through the course and you'll really enjoy it as well. And you'll come out of it feeling like a different pharmacist and a much better and more developed pharmacist than perhaps you started at.
Thank you, Danny. I think that's some really good advice. So I think it's been an informative session, hopefully for healthcare professionals looking to source a DPP and to apply to university for their IP qualification. And yeah, to go through the types of things they need to think about and look out for when finding a suitable DPP for their 90 hours of learning in practice. So whether you're a university that has any questions or a potential DPP that would like to join, or you're a pharmacy student looking to secure a DPP, please reach out to us and head to our website at dppconnect.co.uk. Thank you.
Thanks, Holly.